Today on Against the Grain, the death penalty, life without parole, and life with parole. These three sentences converged into a virtually indistinguishable regime of extreme punishment in California. So argues Hadar Aviram in her latest book, Yesterday's Monsters, The Manson Family Cases and the Illusion of Parole. I'm CS. We'll re-present a conversation with the UC Hastings law professor coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. In 1969, Charles Manson and several of his followers carried out a series of brutal and grisly murders in Southern California. He and six others were tried and sentenced to death in 1971. Yet none were executed because each of their death sentences was commuted to life with parole. But why life with parole as opposed to life without the possibility of parole? And why have none of these people been let out on parole more than 50 years after the slayings? In her new book, Hadar Aviram argues that the Manson family cases played a key role in the shift toward extreme incarceration in California, what she calls the trifecta of extreme punishment, the death penalty, life without parole, and life with parole, blended, she argues, into an indistinguishable regime, largely because of the way the parole process has been manipulated and politicized. Hadar Aviram is professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law. Her new book is Yesterday's Monsters, The Manson Family Cases and the Illusion of Parole. I should say that Charlie Manson died in prison in 2017, and the names of the six followers I referred to earlier are Susan Atkins, Robert Bobby Beausoleil, Bruce Davis, Patricia Krenwinkle, Leslie Van Houten, and Charles Tex Watson. Atkins died in 2009. When Hadar joined me recently in studio, I asked her about the basic thrust of her book.
Not a lot of people know about California parole and what happens in parole hearings in California for people serving life sentences. And I very much wanted to find out. And I wanted to use as my vehicle a case that would be interesting and high profile enough to interest people in actually finding out what happens behind these walls in this process that nobody's familiar with. And I decided that a good case study would be looking at the Manson family inmates, and thought to myself, I wonder if I write to the Department of Corrections and ask them to send me all the transcripts if that would be available. And they are available because transcripts of parole hearings are all in the public domain. They were very gracious. They sent them all to a CD for me for a very reasonable fee. And so I have a treasure trove of 50 years worth of parole hearings in these cases, which have the advantage of covering a whole span of the history of how California does this kind of severe punishment. And so the book basically tells two stories. It tells the stories of how these cases changed California punishment, but it also shows how the changes in California punishment in turn changed these cases and how they've impacted the hearings of these people.
What is parole? Basically, how does it work?
So parole originally comes from a French word meaning word, which is that you give your word that you're going to be good. And the idea is that you get released, presumably before the time that you're supposed to be released, in return for your agreement to abide by a particular set of terms. That's the concept. It works very differently in different countries. It works differently in different states. Here in California, at least until recently, it was limited to a fairly small category of people, the folks that are doing a sentence of life with parole. And that means that at some point in your life sentence, which can be after 15 years or after 25 years, you come up before this committee, this board of commissioners or vice commissioners, and they talk to you and ask you questions. They talk about your past and about your present in the prison and about your plans for the future. And they make a decision whether they're going to recommend to release you. That decision then goes to the California governor, who has to either approve or veto it. if the governor approves the decision to release you, then you agree to abide by a particular set of terms. You're assigned a parole agent that essentially accompanies you in your first steps on the outside. You have to report. You have to show that your drug tests are clean, that you're basically keeping up with what you promised to do. And you're under a certain period of parole. Now, everybody who gets out of California prison is under a particular period of parole, a mandatory parole. But only people who are lifers come up for parole to even decide whether they're going to come out or not. Everybody else comes out at the end of their sentence, and then they have this period of supervision.
Well, we're going to be talking about the parole hearings at which Charles Manson and his followers have appeared over many decades. So let's remind people who Charles Manson was and briefly the murders that he and his followers committed in 1969.
So we are a little bit over the 50th anniversary of the murders. In the late 60s, 1967, Charlie Manson gets released from prison after having spent, at that point, he was in his early 30s. He had spent most of his life behind bars for a variety of crimes, including some fairly violent crimes. And the first place he comes to is the Haight-Ashbury. The Haight-Ashbury at the time, it's after the Summer of Love. There's diseases and violence and sexual exploitation everywhere. It's not a pretty place, and it's not a comfortable place to be. There's a lot of people lost in the Haight-Ashbury at the time. And like many other self-fashioned gurus at the time, he starts accumulating followers, mostly young women, teenagers, women in their late teens, early 20s, who start following him. He gathers a few dozen followers. They buy a bus. They take out the seats. They paint it all black, and they start driving up and down the California coast. And at some point, they settle in a ranch near L.A. called the Spahn Ranch, which used to serve as a ranch for shooting movies, shooting westerns. At this point, there are several stories about what happened, but at least according to the story that most people are familiar with, Charlie Manson starts talking to his followers about this apocalyptic war that's going to happen, a race war. If this sounds far-fetched to some of our listeners, keep in mind we're talking about 68, 69. So the idea of race riots and a race war was not as far-fetched as it might seem from the distance of time. And hopes that this race war eventually will result in him and his followers asserting dominance over the world. When the race war fails to materialize, the followers are being sent to commit murders to sort of jumpstart the race war. And there's a series of four heinous murders that different mixes of people are involved with in each of the scenes, starting with the murder of a musician and music teacher called Gary Hinman, who the family is trying to extort money from. Then the murder that they're most infamous for, which is the killing of Sharon Tate, who was at the time 9 months pregnant. She was a very promising actress and the wife of Roman Polanski, and her friends at the mansion at 150 Cielo Drive. The following night, they murder Lino and Rosemary LaBianca, also in Los Angeles. And later, they murder a ranch hand from Spahn Ranch by the name of Shorty Shea, who they suspect is going to reveal something about them or their complicity in the crimes. They get subsequently arrested. There's a lot of bumbling in police departments about who is to blame for this. Nobody knows. They finally find them. This is largely due to the fact that Susan Atkins gives a jail confession to some cellmates of hers who reveal this to law enforcement. And they have a trial. The trial is extremely scandalous. It makes news all over the world. And at the end of it, both Manson and his followers all get the death penalty. And this is 1971. But in 1972, there's a reversal of fortune, because two court decisions abolish, or at least temporarily abolish, the death penalty. And everybody who is doing time on death row in California gets their sentence commuted to life with parole.
We are talking in the California context. We are talking about People versus Anderson, correct?
That's right. So People versus Anderson is a case that comes to the California Supreme Court a few months before the U.S. Supreme Court decides the much more renowned Furman versus Georgia. And in People versus Anderson, essentially the Supreme Court of California says, we just don't want the death penalty. The death penalty debases us. You know, it's not a sentence that has dignity. It's unconstitutional. And they just completely get rid of the death penalty. It's a decision written 8-1. The sole dissenter is furious. He holds a press conference the day before the decision is announced. Governor Reagan is outraged. What is this? Especially some of the outrage comes from the fact that at that point, everybody's waiting to see what the Supreme Court's going to say about the death penalty in Furman. So they're outraged that California is up the ante, and the riding waves of public sentiment that was very supportive of the death penalty. Because at that point, after a few years in the 60s in which finally opposition to the death penalty topped support for the death penalty, there's now a reversal of fortune. Most Californians actually support the death penalty. And immediately upon this decision, there is a voter initiative to reinstate the death penalty and to declare that it's constitutional. And a few months later, Furman versus Georgia comes out. It's a much more modest decision than People versus Anderson. And basically what they say is there are some procedural ways in which the death penalty is administered that are arbitrary. The jury decisions don't give enough discretion, et cetera, et cetera. And Georgia needs to fix this thing before it has an appropriate death penalty. And the California voters listen fairly carefully. There is immediately a proposition on the books to reform the death penalty to comply with the requirements of Furman. And indeed, in 1976, the death penalty comes back to the United States with Gregg versus Georgia. And a couple of years after that, in 1978, California comes up with a death penalty statute that complies with Gregg, and the death penalty comes back. But at that point, the people that had been commuted during the uproar after People versus Anderson cannot get the death penalty again. Their sentences have been commuted, and those people are going to be coming up for parole.
Now, as you said earlier, the sentences of Manson and his fellow convicts were commuted from death to life with parole. Why weren't they commuted to life without parole?
So this is kind of curious because we're now experiencing this debate where I'm seeing some of the presidential candidates for 2020 opining on, you know, is the death penalty a good thing? You know, should we do life without parole? And many people wonder, why were these people coming up for parole at all? Why weren't their sentences changed from death penalty to life without parole? And the answer is California at the time didn't have life without parole. Life without parole came to California only in 1978. And in large part, this is because of these cases. So these cases are serving as a cautionary tale. In the legislation, there's a lot of talk about how we have to have this something in between life with parole and the death penalty for precisely these kinds of situations to ensure that the person doesn't see the light of day, even if they don't get the death penalty. And that's when life without parole gets introduced. But at the time, people who got life with parole, this is going to be very alien to people familiar with the system today. If you got life with parole, you would start coming up for parole after 7 years. Now, this may sound like a very light sentence, like the idea that you would get out after 7 years. It's important to keep in mind that sentences in the 70s in general were much lighter than they are now. So it was not at all rare for someone who was being convicted of even first-degree murder to get out after 10 years, 15 years. Specifically regarding the women in these cases who were largely known as the Manson girls, there was real concern among the victims of the crime that they would actually be out in 7, 8, 10 years. We know from the victims' memoirs that they saw the fight to keep these people behind bars as an uphill battle because at the time it was not unreasonable that that would be the entire sentence.
Hadar Aviram joins me. She's professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law. We were talking about her new book, Yesterday's Monsters, The Manson Family Cases and the Illusion of Parole. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. How did the California public react to the commutations that resulted from the California Supreme Court decision that basically rejected the death penalty, that declared the death penalty unconstitutional according to the California Constitution?
So the public is in uproar. The public is up in arms about this. They think of the Supreme Court as having basically usurped the will of the public. And several of the voter initiatives that come in the heels of this are essentially trying to capitalize on this public uproar, basically telling people if California voters support the death penalty, that is what should have ruled the day. And the outrage comes not just from the Manson family, but because in the same group of people who had their sentences commuted, they call them the class of 72, all the people whose sentences got commuted from death to life with parole, there's a bunch of other notorious murderers. And these are people that are very sort of etched into the memory of the state as truly scary and dangerous people. The prospect of them getting out is really disturbing for the public. And that leads to a number of legislative things that happen. So the first thing that happens is that in 1976, the whole system of sentencing in California completely changes. It used to be that your sentence would be that a judge would give you a sentence. It would be sort of a range. The judge would say, you know, something like 3 to 20. And whether you come out after 3 or after 20 years would be basically the purview of the parole board. The parole board would talk to you. Some of our listeners are probably familiar with the movie The Shawshank Redemption and the scenes where Red comes before the parole board and they ask him, are you rehabilitated? And he says, yes, I'm rehabilitated. That's God's honest truth. You know, no danger to society here. And so the public starts feeling very antsy about people sort of, you know, deceiving the parole board into letting them out. And that's why in 1976, Jerry Brown is governor at the time, and the sentencing system completely changes to being a determinate sentencing system. So now the legislature is actually writing down the exact sentences for felonies. It comes hand in hand with a requirement that people are going to actually serve the vast majority of their sentences. So there's very little for the parole board to do. California is one of the first states that does it. Other states do it as well. In some states, they even completely obliterate the parole boards. 14 states completely get rid of it. California keeps it only for life with parole, only for this category of lifers with parole. And gradually, future legislation sort of ups the year that you become eligible for parole until you don't even see the board before 25 years had passed.
And what is what you just said? How does it relate to your contention, and there's no reason to doubt it, that the number of years that a person with life without parole starts to become indistinguishable from the number of years that somebody who has a life with parole sentence has?
So this is a really sticky conundrum, I think, in California punishment, which is that we have three versions of extreme punishment. I call them in the book the trifecta of extreme punishment. We have the death penalty, we have life without parole, and we have life with parole. And supposedly they're supposed to be distinguished from each other. But if you look at the legislation that happened in the aftermath of the Manson murders, much of which relied on the Manson cases as a cautionary tale, essentially what they're doing is they're blending all these three forms of punishment into one indistinguishable form of essentially interminable incarceration. So the first thing that we have to keep in mind is that the distinction we draw between the death penalty and life without parole doesn't really hold a ton of water. We're not actually executing anything in the state, certainly not now after the moratorium. But even before the moratorium, we executed since 1976 only 13 people. Meanwhile, more than 100 had died of natural causes. So the difference between being on death row and doing life without parole, there's a difference in conditions and in litigation, of course, and in various other things. But in terms of what your sentence actually is you don't get executed and you die in prison. Now, what about life with parole? Because life with parole is now seen through these cautionary eyes because of what happened with the Manson family, they start upping the time that a person has to serve before they even see the board. And the board itself gradually develops this very suspicious perspective on people's remorse, on people's insight about their crimes. I talk about this plenty in the book with regard to these cases, to the point that almost nobody gets released at their first hearing. Often it takes numerous hearings before you get released. And in general, the average time that somebody spends in prison before they are paroled has gone up from an average of 12 years in 1980 to an average of 28 years in 2012. And the reason for that, and by the way, I should say, this is only people who have already been released, because there are a lot of people who haven't even gotten into the statistics who have done much longer time and are actually still behind bars. So the average is actually much higher than what I've just mentioned. So part of this is the suspicion of the parole board itself, changes in the structure of the parole board, who are the actual commissioners, which are political appointees of the governor, almost invariably from law enforcement background, so not people with a background in therapy or the like. So there's that. And there's the extra layer that gets added in 1988, which is that the governor has a veto right over the parole decision, which adds one more gatekeeping mechanism to keep people behind bars.
Yeah, the politicization of the parole board is a key development in your mind. So in other words, what was the parole board? What did it look like before it was politicized in the sense of it was loaded, it was supplied with appointees from the governor and, as you said, law enforcement types?
So one of the things that I often tell people is that the big debates in the 70s about law and order and punishment in California were not so much between right and left, but between politicians and professionals. So at the time, the California prison system was rife with professionals. Rehabilitation ruled the day. That's not to say that actual rehabilitation was going on, but at least that was the aspiration. And basically, you were looking at people like psychologists, social workers, you know, therapists, folks that were sort of toiling at their job in relative obscurity and were fairly confident that they would make whatever decisions they deemed were right based on the person's rehabilitation or progress, being fairly insulated from the public eye. What happens in the 70s is that this gets upended to some extent by the process becoming more politicized. So as the sentences become determinate, basically, the power that decides who is going to stay behind bars no longer rests with the parole board and the professionals. It rests with the legislature, which is elected, and it rests with essentially voter initiatives, which is how we make law in California. So that gets changed quite a bit, and the professionals start losing their power. It's interesting that even some police departments objected to this change. The LAPD has a letter in the original file written to Jerry Brown saying, well, why don't you just let the parole people do what they're doing? That's their profession. That's their business. That's what they do. Which is why I say this is not about right or left or safety versus, you know, bleeding heart liberals. This is more about politics versus professionalism. Then there's, of course, the extra political layer, which is that the governor has a veto right, and it doesn't work both ways. So it's not that if the board decides not to let somebody out, the governor can outrule that and let them out. It only works to keep people behind bars. Gradually, governors appointed people that they thought would work, and I'm talking former police chiefs, former sheriffs, former people from the correctional structure, so very, very few, maybe just a smattering of people from the defense or the public attorney side, nobody with a therapy background. In fact, until a few years, there wasn't any continuing education for parole commissioners, so they wouldn't get education on, say, substance abuse, mental health, dual diagnosis, lots of things that are relevant to figuring out if somebody is safe to let out or not. So all of that is a relatively new development introduced recently. So all of that becomes fairly political. And then there's this extra wrench that's thrown into the mix, and that's the increasing attention to voices of victims, which further politicizes the process.
Could one argue, Hadar, that, you know, before the parole board with all these sort of professionals and therapeutic folks, that it was insulated from public accountability, and therefore there is something good about having a kind of politicization of the board in that at least a quote representative of the people, the governor, is appointing some people to be part of this group, and therefore there is some sort of built-in accountability?
I think a lot of this depends on how somebody feels about our political culture in California. I've had conversations about this with, for example, friends from New York, where the politics isn't so public and so populistic, and they say, well, we could use some more public accountability and not just have, you know, appointed officials do whatever they want. I think the problem here is that to a great extent, what we see is mostly victims and victim families. And I'm talking about very particular types of victims, not necessarily representative of the entire population of victims of violent crime in California, are taking the process. Their voices get a lot of prominence because we listen to victims and we really value victims' voices. And they're being taken to being completely synonymous with not letting people out, as if there's this dichotomy. Either you are with victims, in which case you don't let people out, or you are disregarding victims and putting public safety at risk. So that's the risk that we run. And moreover, the way we do public opinion increasingly, I show this in the book when I talk about letters of support and letters of opposition to the board, is it used to be that the people writing letters to the board were people who actually knew the victims or actually knew the offenders. Like people would write a letter, you know, this is my uncle, I know them, they can stay with me. These days, everything's done online. So every time a parole hearing for one of these people comes up, the Tate family or somebody else will put up an online petition opposing their release. Even people who have nothing to do with the Tate family, and thousands of people sign up. So it's become not so much knowledgeable input about the actual risk that the person poses to society, but just this sort of opinion poll on whether you support the victims in their pain.
Sharon Tate, one of the victims of the Manson family murders in 1969. I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Hadar Aviram teaches law at UC Hastings College of the Law. She's the author of Cheap on Crime, Recession-Era Politics and the Transformation of American Punishment, and The Legal Promise and the Process of Justice. And her new book, out from University of California Press, is called Yesterday's Monsters, The Manson Family Cases and the Illusion of Parole. So this issue of victims, the expression of victim sentiments in the context of parole hearings, There was a victim's bill of rights in the form of Prop 8 approved in 1982, which said that victims' impact statements were to be allowed prior to sentencing and at parole hearings. And then there was Marcy's Law, which was another Prop 8, but this was in 2008, approved by California voters in November 2008. Who was behind Marcy's Law, and what did it provide?
The story of Marcy's Law is interesting because it's really emblematic of what happens in California in bills of criminal justice. So we have a victim's family, Henry Nicholas, who is a tech entrepreneur. His sister gets murdered, and they are pushing for this bill ostensibly to advance victims' rights. And they really struggle. The guy who does it continues to taunt them later, and the story is really heart-wrenching. But what ends up happening as a consequence is that the public ends up voting for a bill that the public perceives as a victim's rights bill, which actually doesn't do a lot to actually improve the lot of victims, because as you've mentioned, there has been a victim's bill of rights, and this one is largely duplicative of the same thing. What this one does, though, is it also makes it very difficult to get off on parole. And the major issue in Marcy's Law is that it basically sets up the default time between parole hearings to 15 years. So if you go up for parole and you get denied, you have to wait ostensibly 15 years until you come up again.
15 years.
15 years. Although if the commissioners find otherwise that maybe there's reason, then so basically everything that happens on parole now is an exception to Marcy's Law, because nobody has to wait 15 years. So the law was very unrealistic in terms of its thinking about people. But it also makes it much more complicated to deal with the fact that the victims and the offenders are together in the same room. So some of the things that got introduced in terms of Title 15, which is the place in law that deals with what victims do in the actual parole room, is first of all, it allows a lot of people who are not the actual victims of the crime to be in the room. So in addition to the victim having a support person, there's also a victim advocate who doesn't necessarily have to be a victim of the crime. And so when I actually look at this in my book, I look, for example, in one of the cases, in Tex Watson's case, and I look to see how many people actually attended these hearings on the victim side, it grows from one person to 17 people. And many of these folks are not people who were direct victims of his. You see a pretty strong presence of the Tate family in all the hearings, regardless of whether those people were actually involved of the murder of Sharon Tate or even knew about the murder at the time. If she can't show up as a next of kin of the victim, she'll show up as a victim advocate. A lot of these people will come in, and not only will they testify about their own experiences, often they talk about relatives that they don't even know because the murder was so long ago. So people who might have died when this person was an infant or before they were even born. They will read letters from other victims. So essentially, the victim voice becomes very amplified at these hearings. And it's also very artificial because the commissioners don't limit it in time. So this can go on for several hours. And moreover, the inmates are not allowed to directly address the victims, which leads to all kinds of weird situations in which inmates would like to express remorse or regret or And they really can't. They can't address directly the victim. Victims who don't know this, and there are victims who are unaware of this rule, will later go out and say, this person has never apologized to me. They've never written me a letter. But the whole scene is not really conducive to getting people to have a genuine conversation about remorse and about you know, what to do to make up for something terrible that has happened. It's a very artificial conversation. And largely the outcome of this is that victims who actually do feel that they have forgiveness in their heart and they would like the person to get out don't really have a say in this. In the 1990s, a cousin of the LaBiancas, Susan LaBurge, actually went and attended a hearing for Tex Watson. An interesting factoid is that both LaBurge and Tex Watson are born-again Christians, so apparently they bonded on the basis of their shared faith. She shows up at the hearing to testify basically for him and say, you know, I've forgiven him and I'm here actually to support his release. She gets accosted in the parking lot after the hearing by Doris Tate, who scolds her very harshly for essentially espousing this view. The Tate family very resolutely believes that the reason Victims' Bill of Rights exists is only to espouse punitive views. So you cannot express any views of any other nature. This, when I read about this, it reminded me a lot of the public debate recently about the murder of Botham Jean and how his brother Brand Jean comes and hugs the murderer in the courtroom. And people felt very uneasy with this display of forgiveness. And I think it's because people are just not used to victim forgiveness, because the loudest voices of victims are always punitive voices. There is plenty of forgiveness, or at least non-punitiveness, but it gets drowned in the sound of more influential and more famous victims.
Now, are parole decisions, have any studies been done on this? Are parole decisions in California, in fact, affected by victim statements?
The commissioners claim that they aren't. So the commissioners say, you know, we basically give them a voice because it's important, because it's part of the process, but they claim that they are not swayed by that. It's really hard to do research on this, partly because in some crimes, victims show up consistently. In some crimes, the victims will show up for the first or second hearing, and then they'll drop off and they won't show up anymore. So there's a lot of intersecting variables. And this is complicated by the fact that very few people actually get out on the first hearing. So it may very well be that if the victims just attend the first hearing, it may just be a coincidence that the person's not getting out. So we don't know that this actually has a value. There is one situation where it is very important to hear the voice of the victim, and that's when we're dealing with someone who really is still a danger to an existing victim. And that's where you have to craft parole terms in a way that is actually going to protect the victim, or decide not to release the person if they're still dangerous. But that's not really the case here. The case here is much more symbolic. In the book, I recount fairly extensively the last hearing that Susan Atkins has in 2010. Susan Atkins gets wheeled into that hearing on a gurney. At that point, she has a brain tumor. She's barely responsive. She lies down and essentially sleeps almost the entire hearing. And ends up dying half a year later. And her husband, who is a Harvard-educated lawyer, James Whitehouse, comes to represent her at the hearing. And he says, well, let her at least die at home. She's obviously not going to be a danger to the public anymore. I have the resources to try and take care of her. It's really heart-wrenching to read the transcript. At some point, the commissioners mock him for having good health insurance to take care of her. Deborah Tate testifies extensively about how even in this reduced stage, and again, keep in mind that the woman is in the room lying on a gurney the whole time. I have a picture of this in the book, because a picture is really worth 1,000 words here. She says she's still a danger because there are still people who look up to her and who want to emulate her or what have you. And the commissioners end up not letting her out, and she dies in prison. So I think it's important to keep in mind that the victim's voice, even if it doesn't have a sway, it adds up to this big chorus about sort of releasing or not releasing something being, you know, a reward or a punishment for a bad thing that you've done, rather than a reflection of whether you actually are a risk to the public.
Is it at least true that the victim statements are confined to the crime of commitment, you know, the facts and circumstances of the crime, or the original crime, and the victim's sense that they would be in danger if the defendant, if the inmate were released?
It used to be the case that the reason you had input from the victims was to hear about the crime. That is no longer true. It started changing in the mid-80s, and the range of issues on which they're allowed to opine, not just them, but also the prosecutor who's present in the room, has really expanded. In the book, I talk about the prosecutor and the victims as becoming what I call the moral memory block of the hearing, essentially basically opining on anything involving whether this person should get out or not. There's one hearing in particular in 2012 where I talk about how victims and witnesses show up. It's Bruce Davis's hearing, and Bruce Davis does not show up to the hearing because he had a medical problem, which apparently the commissioners know about because he collapsed in the room from that medical issue in the previous hearing. So he's in the hospital, and at the hearing, Barbara Hoyt, who's one of the witnesses, who is not a victim of Bruce Davis and comes as like a victim advocate, says, I'm a registered nurse. I demand to know what his problem is and whether he shouldn't be here. It was a lot of trouble for me to show up here. So there's this sense that you're entitled to know a lot of things about these people and opine about aspects that don't really relate to your experience as a victim at all. But we see this with the prosecutors as well. In the early hearings in the 70s and early 80s, the prosecutors come into the hearing and they're basically there to recount points about the crime if they're needed for a conversation about the crime of commission. But gradually their role expands and they start opining about how dangerous the person is, what kind of person they are, even people who are not the original prosecutors at the original trial, you know, you will hear statements of value like she has ice in her veins instead of blood, like things like that coming out of the prosecutor. So the moral memory block essentially expands beyond just talking about the original crime to just opining about anything involving whether the person should be let out.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Hadar Aviram joins me in studio, A-V-I-R-A-M. She is professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law. And we're talking about her new book, Yesterday's Monsters, The Manson Family Cases and the Illusion of Parole. The book examines the California parole process through 5 decades of parole transcripts that Hadar has gone through in the Manson family cases. And again, Charlie Manson and a number of his followers were convicted in 1971 of several murders committed in 1969. They were sentenced to death. And then in 1972, their death sentences, and in fact, all death sentences in California, were commuted to life with parole because of the California Supreme Court decision in 1972 banning the death penalty in California, calling it unconstitutional. And so beginning in 1978, Manson and his followers, his fellow inmates, were eligible for parole. And I want to mention the names of the murder participants: Susan Atkins, Robert Bobby Beausoleil, Bruce Davis, Patricia Krenwinkle, Leslie Van Houten, and Charles Tex Watson. And which of these people, Hadar, are still in prison?
So all of these people are still in prison. Susan Atkins died in 2010. Everybody else is still in prison. It's important to mention that 3 of these people have been recommended finally for parole: Leslie Van Houten, Bruce Davis, and Bobby Beausoleil. And all of these decisions, all of these recommendations have been reversed by the governor, most recently by Gavin Newsom.
And Manson died in November 2017 at the age of 83 after 46 years behind bars. Let's step back and talk about the numbers of people who are on death row and who have this life with parole or life without parole in California. So, as you write, since its reinstatement in California, the death penalty as a sentence has been oft imposed. How often have people actually been executed?
So since 1976, we executed 13 people, but more than 100 people since then have died of natural causes on death row.
Do you have a sense of how many people are on death row right now?
We have about 750 people, and even though we have a moratorium on the death penalty, all of these people are still on death row and are still litigating as if they were on death row. So we're spending the same kind of money that we did before the moratorium, even though we're not executing people.
And how many people in California are serving life without parole?
So we currently have in California about 4,600 people doing life without parole, but there is a much larger number of people who are doing something very comparable to life without parole. The life with parole population is in the 25,000. So overall, we're talking about 30,000 people who are in prison and will be in prison for decades.
The blurring line, as you were talking about, between life without parole and the death penalty, is that why life without parole has been called the other death penalty?
Yes. These are arguments that we often have whenever there's a call to figure out if we would need to abolish the death penalty. There will be the people who make the argument. I've actually just seen it today, made the argument that you can't really support life without parole because it's exactly the same as the death penalty. And there's a certain logic to this idea. I personally support abolishing the death penalty because I think change is incremental. And I think you have to get rid of death penalty before people are even ready to talk about life without parole. But there is more than a kernel of truth in the people arguing the opposite, which is that actually, because we don't really execute people, both of these sentences, setting aside the price tag and the incarceration conditions, are basically the same. And life with parole is very similar to that. It used to be that parole was a gateway to hope, that was the way for you to get out. It's now changed, especially since the mid-80s, and it's basically become a situation where no matter what you say, you're going to be damned if you do, damned if you don't, you're not going to be let out.
Now, your argument that the Manson family cases, they contributed to the shift toward extreme punishment in California, can we generalize that argument to more of a, well, it's about fear. It's about fear in the public's minds and hearts that creates the conditions politically in which these kinds of propositions can be approved by the California public, these bills and laws can be passed by the California legislature that ramp up, that make laws more extreme, that make punishments more extreme, and that make parole harder to get?
Absolutely. Most of this, in fact, is about fear. And what's amazing is that when you look at people's actual biographies and you try to sort of set aside the conditions of the murder, which was, after all, 50 years ago, you see people that are not actually, or arguably, again, people can disagree on this, but you could make a solid argument that some of these people are not a danger to public safety whatsoever. We're talking about people in their 70s. Many of them are married. Many of them have advanced degrees. They're living their lives quietly in prison, and they're not harming anyone. They don't have any intention to harm anyone. People change. And yet, I think that there is something not just about sort of the political notoriety of this particular case, but something about fear in general that's acting here. It's true that having a famous high-profile case is a big deal in terms of fear. Criminologists tend to call these cases red ball cases. These are cases that sort of, you make policy because there's this one case that's so awful that you want to prevent that from happening ever again. And in many ways, this is the case. We know of Joan Didion and other people that widely were commenting about how Manson killed the 60s. You know, we thought the world was beautiful and nice and everything was about peace and love. And it turned out that that was not the case. But whenever we see a violent case, we are horrified and we want to prevent that from happening again. What we forget is that part of the reason that horrible crimes are so shocking to us is also because they're so rare. And so, of course, we need to be concerned with the victims of those particular crimes, but that doesn't mean there's a risk to everybody, especially now that violent crime rates are so low. And nonetheless, we make policy on the basis of this. And this means that even if on the books the law seems to be reasonable, like, for example, after Lawrence, we're looking at releasing people, we're not just looking at the heinousness of the crime, we're looking at some nexus between what's going on now. Nonetheless, the parole board will bring in the facts of the past crime in the back door. And this is done through a concept called insight, which I think is really central to understanding what this parole thing is all about.
Yeah, let's talk about insight. So when I think of what the parole board wants from the defendant, from the inmate, I think of, right, some sort of expression of, you know, I feel bad about what I did and I'm truly sorry about what I did and I'll never do it again. Is that what insight is about? Is that the content of insight that's expected from the inmate?
So the facetious answer to this question is that insight is basically whatever the parole board wants it to be. Insight is a very amorphous concept, and it gets interpreted in different ways in different cases. It's a combination of remorse and this kind of, I once was blind, but now I see sort of idea that now, having done time, I look back on my crime and I have this deep understanding of why I did that. But the parole board is only prepared to hear certain types of narratives about the crime as opposed to others. So, for example, if you want to tell a story that's more contextual about your crime, like it was the 60s, you know, I was being sexually exploited, I was hopped out of my mind on drugs, I was hungry all the time, all of which is true for many of the perpetrators in these crimes, you can't make these arguments because it seems as if you're minimizing your responsibility. Minimizing is a big word on parole. So you basically have to craft a narrative, all of which focuses around your own guilt. Folks who have visited prison and participated in prison programming probably know what I'm talking about. There's this tendency to sort of constantly assume responsibility, sort of not even mention any other factors that were, you know, around my life, like poverty or living in a bad neighborhood or something like that, because that appears as if you're trying to shirk responsibility. On the other hand, if you take full responsibility and you talk about your crime as having been a heinous thing, you're reminding everybody that you're essentially a monster. So that's not a great thing either. So you're sort of in a bind. And there's an extra layer to the bind, which is that most people come up for parole multiple times. So you've told a story about your inside and it didn't work because the parole board decided not to release you. And then a couple of years later, you come up for parole again. You have to come up with something that wasn't in the previous hearing because obviously that didn't work. You have to say something persuasive about insight that you've now understood. Now, the folks in my book have been coming up for parole dozens of times. So how much more introspection can you possibly expect? There's this bottomless well of introspection where you have to dig in. You know, maybe it's my mother figure, maybe it's my father figure, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And you can never really get to the bottom of this because you're never going to say anything that's going to satisfy people about why you committed a murder, because people shouldn't be murdering people. And so it's very, very difficult to hit the right note on this insight thing. And again, that's complicated also because just using the word insight might imply that you're not genuine and that you're just using jargon to try and get out. So you, I call it in the book rehearsed authenticity. So you have to really choreograph very carefully what exactly you're going to present as your insight, but it has to come off as natural and authentic.
The book is Yesterday's Monsters, The Manson Family Cases, and The Illusion of Parole. It's just out or will be shortly out from University of California Press. And the author is my guest in studio, Hadar Aviram, professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law. Her blog, California Correctional Crisis, covers criminal justice policy in California. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Hadar, what does the vagueness of these terms, insight and remorse, say and mean about the degree of discretion that the parole board can wield, can exercise?
So the parole board has almost unfettered discretion in trying to determine whether somebody's showing insight or showing remorse. The problem is that there's a lot of hubris and there's very little humility about how much we can actually gauge whether another person is expressing remorse. There is plenty of psychological research to show that it's actually quite difficult to tell when people are remorseful or not, when they're being truthful or not, and that it's the people that have the most confidence in their ability to determine people being disingenuous that are least capable of telling lies from truth. And that includes cops. Now, recall that the commissioners are, for the most part, former law enforcement people, and they have this immense confidence in their ability to tell whether somebody is really being genuine or whether they're faking it. I tell in the book about this one opportunity that I was at a social occasion and I met somebody who works at CDCR, at the Department of Corrections, and a journalist who used to be a lifer, who used to be incarcerated for a long time. And we talked about the book, and the CDCR guy said, well, you know, you have to be in the room. There's a lot of nonverbal communication that allows them to tell if somebody's telling the truth about their insight or not. And the journalist started giggling and we said, well, what's funny? And he said, well, you know, I was behind bars for a long time and you guys had no idea. I mean, they, of course, got to know the guys because they were doing time with them for years and people were just completely deceiving the board. People that were completely genuine were being turned down. People that were completely deceptive were being let out. So there's this immense hubris that we have about our ability to do this. And moreover, it's very difficult to challenge this kind of thing in court. Because after all, if you get to the California Supreme Court with a case like this, you can argue, you know, the board completely ignored my insight and only talked about the heinousness of my crime. But of course, the board's not going to do that. The board's going to say, this person is not remorseful of their crime. And that's really difficult to challenge unless you are seeing the person and have some sort of an idea of what it is that they're saying. And one of the things that I think that would really benefit this process is just a modicum of humility. After all, you don't really need to make a judgment on whether this is a good person. You don't need a spiritual transformation. What you need is for the person to not be a public safety risk. And there are some objective, humble measurements for that. Is the person working? Do they have a solid release plan? Have they had disciplinaries? There are things that you can rely on to make this determination without having this idea that you are going to be able to see into this person's soul and tell if they've, you know, transformed into a good person.
Hadar, you also write about inmates being blamed or penalized by parole commissioners for not participating in rehabilitative programs that don't exist at the facility that where the inmate is housed or that are not somehow available to the prisoner at that time.
This was one of the big shockers when I researched this. So beyond the conversation about the past, the crime of commitment, there's a long conversation about the present. And that largely revolves around two issues, right? What does the disciplinary file look like? You really can't go to prison for, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years without having at least a few write-ups for various minutia. So all of these get really blown up and discussed, and everything like this is like a microcosm of trying to understand your insight. And then on the other hand, there's the extent to which you're participating in the opportunities that prison is giving you. And the problem with that is that for a very long time, we have not been offering people really great options. In the 1970s and 80s, mostly what we had in prison was academic opportunities, and people that availed themselves of these opportunities, that includes the inmates in my book, were being scolded by the board for not being realistic and not finding a menial profession to work in. And then there's all kinds of other things like anger management and stuff like that. It is not uncommon for the board to require that somebody attend a program that simply does not exist in the prison that they're going to. Moreover, very often people are held in solitary or in some sort of restrictive condition, sometimes not through blame of their own. I mean, a bunch of people in my book were placed in solitary to basically protect them from the Aryan Brotherhood. Because, you know, you're white, you don't join the Aryan Brotherhood, you could be in real trouble in prison. But because of that, they can't access programming, and now they have to explain themselves. And the board essentially penalizes you for not attending the programming. I think in general, if we were looking at the one most impactful change that we could make to the parole system, is to really offer genuine paths, evidence-based, tried and true paths to rehabilitation that actually teach people things that are going to be useful, to make them available at any prison, not just in San Quentin, which happens to have the good fortune to be near the Bay Area with lots of volunteers. And then people can actually avail themselves of that and build a realistic case that they're going to make it on the outside, because otherwise this is all conjecture.
Any other recommendations for reform or somehow changing the parole process to make it more just and equitable?
So beyond toning down our expectations that we can tell who is good and who is bad, I think that getting rid of the governor's veto is going to be a good step in the right direction. These decisions should really not be political. They should be based on whether the person is a risk to society or not. There's no call to have an extra political safeguard there. We have to diversify the board, bring in a lot of people from lots of different backgrounds, including professional backgrounds when they deal with people in therapeutic setting. And we have to find some way to facilitate a conversation between victims and offenders that actually brings about genuine contrition, genuine forgiveness, genuine apologies. Because if you put together in a room a victim and an offender in the context of a parole hearing where they're not allowed to actually talk to each other, no apology offered under these circumstances is going to be regarded as genuine, and we can all understand why. So we have to find a good place to have this conversation, mediated and healthy, outside of the parole room, especially when it has no relevance to whether the person is posing risk or not.
Hadar Aviram, H-A-D-A-R, A-V-I-R-A-M. She teaches law at UC Hastings College of the Law, and we've been talking about her new book. It's called Yesterday's Monsters, The Manson Family Cases and the Illusion of Parole. Hadar, thank you for writing this book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I hope it produces real change.
And that interview first aired on February 10th of this year. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.